Good afternoon, and welcome to Backtracks in Time. I'm Jack Sensabaugh, and today my guest is Ron Gabriel, another local history buff from Catskill. You may remember hearing Ron a few months ago. He was on the show back in November, talking about the Mayone Brickyard in Athens. Today he is going to be talking about another business in Athens, the Imperial Lifeboat and Davit Company, a manufacturer of lifeboats during World War II. And so welcome, Ron.
Glad to be here, Jack. Thank you.
And so why don't we just start with a little bit of history of World War II and where the country was and where the world was at that time.
Jack, at 5:45 a.m. on Friday, September the 1st of 1939, 44 regular German divisions will crash across the German-Polish frontier with the intention of destroying the armed forces of the Polish state. With this invasion, the world is launched into World War II. The war will last for 6 years and one day, from September 1st of 1939, till Sunday, September the 2nd of 1945, when the Japanese will sign surrender documents on board the battleship Missouri, which is anchored in Tokyo Bay. Now, America will participate in the war a couple of years later, actually, to be precise, 2 years, 3 months, and 7 days later, at 7:55 a.m. Honolulu time, when 353 Japanese warplanes flying in two waves off of six fast attack carriers will bomb air and naval forces of the United States stationed at Oahu, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Now, the air raid will sink five American battleships, three of which are lost forever, the Arizona, the Utah, and the Oklahoma. The West Virginia and the California will be refloated and will live to fight another day, albeit pretty late in the game. The West Virginia gets back into the game in July of 1944 and the California in January of 1944. So it takes quite a bit to repair these two battle wagons, as they were known in that day. The air raid will also kill 2,403 Americans, of which 1,177 alone were on board the battleship Arizona. And as most folks listening know, the Arizona to this day is a memorial, a very solemn memorial. Yes. My wife Arlene recently visited there, and she mentioned that when people got into this memorial, because you have to take a ship out to it, it's out in the water, and she said, boy, when you got in there, it was she had a very difficult time explaining the experience. She said there was people spoke in hushed tones. Nobody told them they had to, but everybody just did. And she said it was a feeling unlike any other she'd ever experienced in her life. So the Arizona, as we know then, is still there and is a, I guess you could say, a sad reminder of the day of infamy.
Yes.
Franklin Eleanor Roosevelt will call.
Yes, I read an article recently about a gentleman who was, I think he's in his 90s now, he was on one of the, I think on the Arizona that morning, and talks about how he got off, and it's just an incredible story. I mean, the water below him was on fire, he had to crawl over a rope to another ship, and his hands were already blistered and everything from the heat. It's incredible that anybody could survive that. You know, he said the water was sizzling.
It took a while for us to believe this was happening. Try to imagine this was December 7th. It's 1941 in Hawaii.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful morning. Many of our naval forces were sailing over to Ford's Island. They were going to go to Mass. They were going to go to church. A number of the boys were out throwing a baseball around. Yeah. I mean, it's just gorgeous. And when the first wave of planes came in, almost nobody believed it was an enemy attack. Everybody looked up and they thought, well, what's the Army doing? Because remember, it was the Army Air Forces at that time. It wasn't the U.S. Air Force.
Okay.
And a lot of the sailors, well, what is the Army doing now, you know? And what a morning for target practice. And we had a shipment of B-17s coming to Pearl from the mainland, and so some of the other guys thought, oh, maybe these were some of the B-17s coming in. It would take a little while for some of our guys to notice the red meatballs on the wings of the Japanese planes. And then they would realize what was transpiring.
Right.
One of the most chilling radio messages that I think anyone could ever hear is when we finally realized the attack, this was real, mm-hmm. a radio man takes to the radio from Pearl Harbor, and he goes on the air and he says, "Pearl Harbor, air raid. This is no drill. Pearl Harbor, air raid. This is no drill." Right now, as I say that, I get goosebumps.
Yeah.
I mean, I just can't imagine. This is it. We are now at war.
Right.
We're in a global war. You know, they said World War I was the war to end all wars.
Mm-hmm.
We saw nothing until we saw World War II, as bad as World War I was,
yes.
Don't get me wrong. But
we've had a lot of other days of infamy since then.
Oh, for
it's
sure.
Like 60 years later, you know what I'm talking about.
Right.
You know?
Right. So, America's participation in World War II will last for 3 years, 8 months, and 25 days, and we will put, by the time hostilities are over, 16.1 million Americans in uniform. Now, it's important to remember, this was total war. This is the last time we actually declare war on an enemy. We haven't declared war on anybody since.
Oh.
Truman, one of my least favorite presidents, mm-hmm. called the Korean War a police action. One of his many flubs, but we
okay.
won't get into that.
Yeah.
But at any rate, we haven't declared war on an enemy since World War II. We were very clear about our goals. At the very beginning of the war, Roosevelt and Churchill got together and they set down the parameters, and the parameters were simply this: we will accept nothing less than the unconditional surrender of the enemy, right at the outset of the war. So Americans knew very firmly mm-hmm. what was at stake here. We could either fight with everything we had, or we could paint the White House any color the Germans and the Japanese wanted. It was very clear cut. We had been attacked, and Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto was the architect of the Pearl Harbor raid. And his intention was for America to be informed just prior to the strike that a state of war existed. And through all sorts of snafus, the envoys in Washington were unable to get the coded messages from Tokyo deciphered. They had one typewriter, and one man was feverishly typing away. And then when they finally got their orders from Tokyo, they get to the State Department, and they're being held up in the outer office. This is one of those situations where there's a lot of room for blame all the way around.
Right.
But nevertheless, when Yamamoto learns back in Tokyo, first of all, he learns that the raid is a huge success.
Right.
The Japanese scored a tremendous tactical success in this raid. The battle is won, the war is lost, but the battle is won.
Mm-hmm.
One of his great errors is he has Admiral Chuichi Nagumo as the commander of the strike force. Nagumo didn't believe in the raid to begin with. He started right from the outset debunking it. He said it'll never be successful. He didn't believe in it, and yet for reasons of politics and other things that are always up front in every nation, it seems, mm-hmm. Nagumo gets the assignment, much to Yamamoto's chagrin. And right from the outset, Nagumo makes a huge error. He doesn't come back for a third strike. Had they come back, they would have done further damage to our fleet. One of the things they do not do is they do not hit our oil tanks. We have oil fields. They could have destroyed millions of gallons of aviation fuel. They wouldn't know this, but the administration building, had they hit that, that was our headquarters for our decryption process, where we Ultra, we were able to decrypt the Japanese codes. Mm-hmm. We started at the outset. We were reading their mail before they were actually into hostilities. And so had they bombed the administration building, they would have taken out our decrypting mechanism. There were so many things that went wrong. So Nakumo, at the brink of success here, turns tail and runs. And Yamamoto back in Tokyo turned to one of his aides. He said, Nakumo's going to run. He said, I know he's going to run. And he did. But at any rate, when they are having this celebration in Tokyo, they're celebrating the great success of the raid. And Yamamoto learns from one of his aides that America did not know a state of war existed. And he puts his drink down, he sits down, and he's totally deflated. And one of his aides said, Admiral, what's wrong that you've scored a great, great victory here today? Mm-hmm. And Yamamoto sat there and very pensively, very quietly said, the Americans are a just and honorable people, and I can think of no action that would anger them more or be considered more treacherous than what they will perceive to be a sneak attack. Mm-hmm. He said, so prophetically, he said, I fear that we have but awakened a sleeping giant and filled him with a terrible resolve. And he couldn't have been more right.
Yes,
America was outraged. The next day, all over the nation, people were down to the draft board, down to the enlisting stations, and they were going volunteering for the services en masse. You can just the feeling in America, historians have told us, that America was never before and has never since been as united as we were during the course of the Second World War. Mm-hmm. Just unbelievable. You went to a movie theater to see a movie.
Right.
Before the movie, the Star Spangled Banner played.
Really?
And nobody had to be told to stand up, and nobody had to be told to take off their hat. And nobody would dare sit while the Star Spangled Banner would be playing. There would be none of those kinds of off-the-wall protests that would happen here. There were no such things as peace protesters. Had there been, they would have been seen as treasonous cowards. And I would hate to tell you what would have happened to them in that climate. It wouldn't have been pretty. Let's just leave it at that.
Right.
So, we were totally, totally dedicated to this war effort. And so what happens then is that nearly every industry in America converts from the production of civilian goods to the production of military goods. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, in Detroit, General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, Nash, Hudson, you name those, they convert all production from automobiles to tanks, half tracks, deuce and a halves, Jeeps, you name it, anything on wheels. And there will be no new automobiles produced until 1946, after the war.
Wow.
None. Mm-hmm. Wrigley's gum, Wrigley's chewing gum,
yeah,
most of it goes overseas to the soldiers so they could chew it before the... Imagine you're on a landing craft. Imagine you're going to hit the beach.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that steel gate is up and you hear the machine gun bullets bouncing off of it, and you know that in a few minutes that gate's going to go down.
Whoa.
And you're totally exposed to this withering enemy fire. So these guys had chewing gum. They had anything they could have to ease their nerves. Kodak's film, most of it goes overseas for war purposes.
Oh.
I mean, it goes on and on and on. The Lionel Electric Train Company produces no electric trains during the war. All of their machinery in Irvington, New Jersey, would be converted to the production of the finest precision instruments for the Navy, compensating binnacles, oil-filled compasses, Polaris's, Tafel logs, torpedo direction finders, anti-aircraft shell fuses. I mean, it's just endless. So America was so totally dedicated to the war effort. And that's what it was called, was the war effort.
Right.
And you would walk into a store during World War II, and if you would dare have the nerve to ask for some frivolous thing, without fail, the clerk would back off would stare daggers at you and would say in a very loud voice, "What's the matter? Don't you know there's a war on?"
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was nothing. It was funny because in the Depression, there were goods to be purchased, but nobody had money.
Right.
In World War II, we have the exact opposite. With all the war work, there's almost no unemployment. Any able-bodied worker is working. Women for the first time are working en masse. Yep. People have money out the wazoo. I mean, they've never had this much. They're working overtime, and they've got money. There's nothing to buy. And we have meatless Mondays, and we have all sorts of things, scrap drives. You saved lard. When you went into the store, you not only needed money, you needed ration coupons. Mm-hmm. And you had the A card on your car, which was good for 5 gallons of gas a week.
Oh.
That was it. 5 gallons a week with the A card. And it was right on your window. They put black electrical tape over the headlights, and only a tiny little slit would let a little light out. These were to prevent, you know, airplanes, enemy airplanes overhead from seeing your headlights.
Wow.
We would have blackout drills, air raid wardens.
Oh,
with
yeah,
the whistles,
I've seen those.
And
yeah,
you would close your curtains, and you made your house as dark as you could be. And if you dared have a light on, the air raid warden in your neighborhood would be blowing his whistle. "Gabriel, shut that light. What's wrong with you? You want to kill this whole town of Athens?" Blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, we're, it just, it's a time.
Drives and paper, you know, drives and things,
yeah,
too.
Paper drives and, and steel. I mean, I used to tell my children when they were small, we'd drive past a mansion and there'd be a huge, you know, those iron fences, those very decorative. And once in a while, we'd see one and I'd say to the kids, "Oh, that survived World War II." He said, "What do you mean, Dad?" I'd say, during World War II, kids competed. The kid that came in with the most metal, the most scrap, whatever, won an award.
Oh.
And so sometimes a kid would win by going to a very wealthy matron and saying, "Would you donate that fence? And think of how many Sherman tanks we can build out of that fence."
Yeah.
And they would, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I've often... and I say semi-joked, I don't, I guess I'm not really joking.
Okay.
When I talk about people today, you know, and I said to my wife, Arlene, people today have way too much time on their hands. When I see what people get upset about, I mean, if had they lived in World War II, I guess I'm grateful that the generation that fought World War II was the generation that fought World
the
War
greatest
II.
Generation,
I'm not
as
so
I
sure
say.
That this generation in America could today would... I don't know how we do. I'm not so sure how we do.
Hope we never have to find out.
I hope not. For our sake, I hope not.
Right.
Well, at any rate, Jack, I thought that what we might do, now that we've taken a pretty good overview of the war itself, maybe we would take a look at the Imperial Lifeboat and Davit Company in Athens and discuss their contributions to the war. And in this way, we're taking a look at a microcosm of what every company in every town, village, and city in America did during the war.
Okay. And just for the listeners, I did have to look up myself this Imperial Lifeboat and Davit, right. D-A-V-I-T.
Mm-hmm.
I actually thought you were saying data the other night when we were on the phone.
Right.
Then I looked it up. And so I won't give away the definition, but I will let Ron do that. But I had to look it up too, so I learned something myself.
Okay, great.
So take it away, Ron.
All right. So, as we mentioned, it was with all of the things that developed in World War II, that right here in Athens, New York, my hometown, the Imperial Lifeboat and Davit Company came into existence. Now, the property was and is situated on the southeasterly side of South Washington Street in the village of Athens between 4th and 5th Streets in Athens. Okay, so if anyone is driving into Athens today from Catskill, let's say, from the south, as you come up 385, you go, it seems to me like there's a rock cut there to go through, and then you sweep around the bend. And in my whole life, I've always, as I'm sweeping around the bend, look out at the Hudson River, and I get the illusion at that point that the Hudson River is higher than 385. It's not true, of course, but it appears that way. And I always look over at the what used to be the New York Central Railroad tracks across the way.
Yeah.
And to this day, CSX will have parked on those tracks cars for ADM milling and so on.
I see them every time I go through Athens.
There, So as you go around, you'll see that. And the very first structures that you'll see in Athens on the right side will be the site, the buildings that were the Imperial Lifeboat and Davit Company. And as I mentioned to you, Jack, before we went on the air, these buildings, it's a twin Kwanzaa hut style building, speak World War II. They shout World War II. I mean, they look like a couple of Kwanzaa, gigantic Kwanzaa huts that you would have found on any Pacific island in World War II as we island hopped our way to Tokyo.
Right.
And they're very distinct. If anybody has any remote familiarity with World War II, you'll look at those buildings and you'll just say, oh, yeah, World War II, look at this. Now, when you get just past the building, you can take that next street up 4th Street, and you'll be right behind those two giant Kwanzaa hut buildings. They're a heavy concrete block structure with that curved roof. Mm-hmm. And you'll get some sense for the size of these buildings right behind it. And if you look straight ahead of you, if you look at the Hudson River on from 4th Street, there's a slip, which today is used for kayakers.
Okay.
Those nutty people that go out in those odd-shaped boats and paddle their brains out.
Yeah. Know?
But anyway, that little slip, before it was kayak, and many years ago during World War II, was used for a couple of purposes. There would be times when they would float lifeboats into the river there to test them, or I'm told there might be times when they would tie a bunch together and tug them down to the Brooklyn Navy Yard.
Okay.
I guess other times they were trucked down to the Brooklyn Navy Yard. But also in the building there was a pool to test the lifeboats. So the people that worked there were not quite sure, but some folks seem to think there might have been a little testing in the Hudson itself from that little pier right there. And if you've ever been on 4th Street, it's a very small pier even till today.
I drive past. So I'm through Athens every weekend, so I go up to Coxsackie. So I'll have to take a closer look this week.
Go down there. You'll see it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the land was originally owned by William Harmon Brown in the early 1800s, and it would later house the Arrow Ice Company, This is in the 1800s. Later in the 1800s, the land will become the McGee Shipyard and was owned by William F. Rafferty and James F. Dwyer. Now, we're going way back in history here. We're back into the mid and a little bit later 1800s here, but we just want to give you a little history of the land.
Sure, definitely.
Okay? On October the 7th of 1908, the property was passed on to Richard Lenehan and then later to Michael A. Lenehan, who would pass away in Athens on January the 17th of 1941. Now, during that era, when the Lenehans owned it, the property was known as either Lenehan's Shipyard or the Athens Shipyard.
Okay.
On June the 6th of 1942, we're into World War II now, the property known as Lenehan's Shipyard was sold. Michael's wife, Sarah Lenehan, will convey the building to a Jerome P. McBraswell and his wife, Frida. So Jerome P. McBraswell will purchase the building June the 6th, 1942. Very important.
Okay.
On May the 22nd of 1942, and this is interesting, May 22nd is earlier than June 6th.
Right.
On May the 22nd of 1942, ground was broken for the new twin buildings, the two Kwanzaa buildings for the production of lifeboats.
Uh-huh.
It is lost to history now as to how it was that ground was broken for this building prior to the closing on June the 6th. But people that I talked to who were familiar with the situation at the time believe that it was due to the wartime emergency situation. That World War II, you could definitely call an emergency. Today we call a lot of things an emergency. World War II was an emergency.
Definitely.
And all sorts of things had to be expedited during the war to help us to win the war.
Right.
Now, it is believed that Mr. McBraswell, who was from Maine, came to Athens with the intention of producing yachts at the location that would become the Imperial Lifeboat and Davit Company. However, with the coming of World War II, those plans will change, and the Imperial Lifeboat and Davit Company is born. The company will have a yearly payroll of $200,000 and will employ 500 workers at its peak.
Whoa.
Now, we need to discuss economics here for a minute.
Yeah.
$200,000 today doesn't sound like a lot of money for a big company's payroll.
Right.
Keep in mind, if you will, the movie It's a Wonderful Life comes out in 1946.
My favorite one of Christmas time. Okay. I love it every year.
Okay. And George Bailey is called to the bank by Mr. Potter. And Mr. Potter is offering him a job.
Yes.
And he says to George Bailey, you're making $15 a week. You save $5 and you're spending $10 and you're going to have children. But the point is, in 1946, George Bailey, who is probably making a little bit more money than the average production worker, is making $15 a week. So I guess it wouldn't be unrealistic to say that in 1942, the average man is making $10 a week.
Right.
So with that outlook on economics, $200,000 seems like a lot more.
Yeah,
or let me put it a different way. A loaf of bread would have cost 3 cents.
Mm-hmm.
A pound of butter would have cost a nickel. The newspaper was a penny. We had penny postcards.
Yes.
To go to the movies, 10 cents.
I know. Everybody says that, you know, prices are so high now. Oh, I remember when it was this. Yeah, but they have to put it into perspective.
That's
right. Okay. Yeah. You can say that in 2017, but 1947 is a whole big different story, you know?
Yeah, everything is
prices
relative.
Are about the same probably, you know, based on your income.
That's
yeah,
right.
Compared to your income.
Everything is relative.
Yeah.
It really is. So that $200,000 payroll, Jack, meant a lot in those days.
Oh, sure.
That was a lot of money. Again, I'm assuming the average man's making around $10 a week. And at that time, just before World War II, gasoline, this is going to make a lot of people awful sick out there, gasoline sold 5 gallons for a dollar.
Oh.
5 gallons for a dollar. And if you were at the right gas station, you might get coupons toward a free set of dishes.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
So
I spent $20 now for 3/4 of a tank of gas.
Tank of gas, right? Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So anyway, now the twin buildings were constructed and production of the lifeboats for the United States Navy would begin during that season of 1942. The first lifeboat is actually turned out in May of 1943 by the time they got the buildings built and got all the raw material and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
The buildings, as I've mentioned to you before, remain to this day and can be viewed from 4th Street. As I've said again, the buildings display the classical architecture of the World War II era. Now, let's take a look at the meaning of lifeboat and davit.
Yes.
Okay.
A little vocabulary lesson for our listeners here today.
Okay. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary gives these two definitions. Lifeboat. A strong boat designed for use in saving lives at sea.
Okay.
That's the lifeboat.
Right.
Davit. Davit is a pair of small cranes for raising and lowering small boats, such as lifeboats. And the cranes are attached to the ship, and they swing the lifeboat out and down into the water.
I think we can all picture it. Now you know what that's called.
Right, exactly. That's the davit. So they produced, the Imperial Lifeboat and Davit Company produced the boat, the lifeboat, and the davit. Now, my father was an employee at Imperial, as were many other men that I knew in Athens in my growing up years. All my heroes were World War II vets. I mean, when I grew up hearing their stories. I'm old enough to remember a little bit about World War II, but in the post-war era, when the boys came home and I heard all their stories, there's nothing better than verbal history, you know, to hear it. And you hear unvarnished, the warts and all, you know, and so I knew many of the men who worked at Imperial. My dad, during the war, he was a little too old to be drafted. My uncle Mike Gabriel wasn't. He was a hero in the war. He was awarded the Silver Star for heroism in action with the 9th Infantry Division in Europe. But at any rate, my dad, again, too old to be drafted and had a large family. Mm-hmm. He tried to make up for it. He was an ice man by day, delivered ice.
Mm-hmm.
He had an ice house on Quarterskill Creek in Catskill.
Future topic of another show,
right.
Ice houses
of
the Hudson River.
Love that one.
Yes.
That's a great thing to talk about. But at any rate, my uncle Frank DelVecchio, my dad ran, Frank Gabriel ran the Green County Ice Company, as it was called. So okay. The phone number is 840. That's three digits. That was it.
Oh,
you picked up the phone, the candlestick phone, the LA Nest mm-hmm. phone, and yeah. Betsy, give me 840. And that's how you ordered your ice. But at any rate, these guys, you know, again, so my dad worked daytime delivering ice. For part of the war, worked at night in the Imperial Lifeboat and Navy Company. For another part of the war, he worked at the Selkirk Yards. The railroads were mm-hmm. critical to our victory in World
yes.
War II. Critical. They carried 98% of all war materiel, and they carried 96% of all military personnel in the United States. It's just a shame what we've done to our railroads.
Yeah.
You know, I've often tried to get people, particularly the liberals. I would think liberals would be big railroad buffs. I don't understand why, yeah. particularly environmental wackos. You'd think they would, you know, like railroads. And I've said to people, if we could just get 10% of the freight that is carried by trucks on roads, pounding our roads to mush, and we pay taxes for those roads. If we get 10% of the freight off the roads in trucks and onto the railroads, we would save 200 million gallons of fuel a year.
Whoa.
And for the environmental wackos, we would put 2.3 million less tons of the pollutant carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Now,
why aren't the environmental wackos into this? Why they're not in favor of railroads, I don't, you know, oh, they're a little noise. Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Sorry, folks, you can't have everything.
Some of us like the sound of a train.
Jack, that's just 10%. That's only 10%. If we get 10% of the freight yeah. off the roads and onto the railroads, 2.3 million tons of pollution less by using the railroad.
That's,
sorry, I couldn't help myself. I got carried away.
That's okay.
But at any rate, my dad during the war would work up in Selkirk as an oiler. When the trains came in, the locomotives, mm-hmm. steam locomotives, he would go and he would oil all the wheels and, mm-hmm. and everything and so on. And they caught a spy up there one time.
Really?
They caught a Nazi spy, saboteur actually, fifth columnist, running along the tops of the boxcars at the Selkirk Yard. And when they grabbed him and they called the FBI and they found he had a satchel loaded with explosives.
Oh, he could have
God only knows
damage, yeah.
Yeah, what he was going to do to the Selkirk Yards.
Yeah.
So, but at any rate, so my dad would often talk about when the lifeboats were complete, Jack.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we shipped them to the Brooklyn Navy Yard complete right down to the flare gun. The flare gun was
yeah.
in there so that when the sailors are marooned out on the ocean in the lifeboat, they see an airplane going by, poof, they fire the flare gun.
Right.
Because imagine you're invisible. That lifeboat floating on that vast ocean.
Yeah.
From the sky, they can't see you.
Yeah.
Isn't that awful? I mean, a horrible, hopeless feeling that has to be.
Definitely.
You know. So at any rate, so we now know what the lifeboat is, and we now know what the davit is.
Right.
Sorry to say that very few Imperial employees survive. However, I was fortunate enough to talk to a few of them, to interview them for the article that I wrote about the company. The folks I spoke to were Richard Brunner, Raymond Cure, Jane Eve and Lone Erickson, Harvey Durham, and one unnamed woman. I had one woman that did not want to be named
okay.
for her own reasons.
Sure.
Much of what I learned about the Imperial Lifeboat and Navy Company was from the things my dad told me and from the things that these folks told me.
You said the best of the history is the oral history right there.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And to me, it was fabulous.
Sure.
So the lifeboats were made of galvanized steel, Jack, 1/16th of an inch thick, 1/16th. The metal arrived at the plant in Athens in flat sheets, and a machine heated and formed the metal into the necessary lifeboat shapes. All the seams had a tar cloth placed between the parts prior to the riveting process in order to ensure a watertight seal, so that this tar cloth gets sealed between two pieces of this sheet metal, and the rivet seals it up as tight as a drum. And the riveters, a couple of these people told me that the Imperial Lifeboat Company in Athens, New York, was known for its excellence in riveting. they had folks in Athens that were just great riveters. I don't know if it's the water.
Maybe.
At any rate.
Any of them named Rosie?
Right.
I had to do it.
I understand. Parts were tacked together, and there were rails in the factory on which parts were moved. The riveter countersunk the hole from underneath the boat, and a bucker, B-U-C-K-E-R, a bucker, was located on the outside of the boat. The rivets were tapered. They were not round-headed. The bucker placed the rivet into the hole from the outside, and then he holds a bar against the rivet. The riveter on the inside then compresses the metal around the rivet with his or her rivet gun, which sounded very much like a machine gun. Okay. To mesh the two pieces of metal against the tar cloth. The rivet head was on the inside of the boat, and it was flush on the outside. A third man, known as a tamper, T-A-M-P-E-R, the tamper used a hammer to tap every rivet spot and push the metal into the tar cloth. Next, they would trim the excess tar cloth, and a good riveter might set 1,000 rivets per day. A good riveter might set 1,000 rivets per day, while a slower riveter might set only 800 rivets a day. Only 800 rivets
Slackers.
A day. Imagine. Next, the lifeboats were tested. Now, here comes a little bit of the dispute. Some of them said the lifeboats were tested in a pool located in the middle of the factory floor. Others weren't sure that maybe they weren't maybe put down that slip and tested in the Hudson River. Perhaps when they had an overload, when they had too many boats, they did both. Just
sure.
Speculation, not sure.
Okay.
And again, when you're doing verbal histories, there's always a little room.
Some
you
details
know,
get fuzzy or we get lost over time, too.
Right. Now, a large bar submerged the boat. I mean, the boat was submerged. And the work crew would stand all around that little pool and look for air bubbles and leaks from the rivets. Every leaking rivet was replaced and retested, and no boat left Imperial in Athens unless they were completely seaworthy.
Great.
They made sure they were so proud of their work, and they weren't going to let their boys, their sailors, sink out in the middle of the ocean because mm-hmm. of shoddy work.
Right.
Okay. The lifeboats had a keel. That was the backbone of a ship, and it ran from the stern to the bow with ribs attached to the sides of the keel. Now, the keel extended, if you can picture it, 1 foot below the waterline to provide stability to the craft, like a big fin.
Yeah.
Can you picture that?
Sure.
So that would help to, you know, keep the boat stable in rough seas.
Okay.
The lifeboats were about 5 feet wide, and they varied in length from 22 to 28 feet long. So 5 feet wide, and depending on the model, 22 to 28 feet in length. Okay? It has been stated that most of the lifeboats were of the 20-foot length category. There were 5 wooden seats in the average lifeboat, and depending on the length of the boat, between 20 and 40 seamen could be loaded into a lifeboat safely. Davits were welded onto the deck of a ship, and lifeboats were hung from the davits by means of ropes and blocks and tackles. In an emergency, men were loaded into the lifeboats, this is interesting, while still on the deck. And then the lifeboat and men in the boats are lowered into the sea.
Okay.
And so this is why every once in a great while, when a tragedy would happen, one of the ropes might break or whatever, it would cast those men sitting in the boat into the sea.
Oh,
see, as they were going on their way down. Or maybe an enemy shell, a shrapnel, might cut a rope or something,
mm-hmm.
and the guys get spilled. But basically, it was felt it was much safer for them to be lowered in the boat into the sea. Basically, if it worked out well, they never got a foot wet.
Right.
If it worked out well.
Yeah, sure.
Now, each lifeboat had pumps to pump water out of the boat if it got swamped while at sea.
Mm-hmm.
And at Imperial, welders installed and welded air tanks to the middle to the inside walls to help keep the boat afloat. And the Maritime Commission ruled that the craft must be able to stay afloat if even only half the tanks were operable. So when they left Athens, they had to make sure that there was enough air, enough tanks, so that half of them, out of commission, they put half of them, they still, that darn boat's going to float. So they took, they took every precaution they could.
Yeah.
You know, they did it. They did a wonderful job. Now, one woman recalls vacuuming out the boats after production finished, and then stenciling on each seat just exactly what items were stored under that spot or under that seat. Okay, each lifeboat was equipped, each one, with 450 items.
450 on one boat?
In each boat.
Gosh.
These items included food, water, medical supplies, fishing tackle to try to catch fish to survive.
Logical.
Survive. Bait, oars, a sail, flare guns, and even a packet of needles to sew your torn breeches. Okay.
Why not?
Food and water were stored in 1, 2, and 3 quart cans. A 40-person boat was stocked with 9 cans of water and 2 cans of food rations for each person. Okay. Over 500 employees worked 2 shifts, I imagine 12-hour shifts, and produced 8 lifeboats a day for the Liberty and Victory fleets in New York City. One worker recalls that about every other night, the air raid siren in Athens would wail, and all the workers had to clear out of the factory and stand out in the street or on the docks next to the blacked-out building. Upon the all-clear siren, the employees would trudge back into the factory and return to work. But everything had to be dark as pitch, again, under the assumption that enemy airplanes coming over would zero in on any lights on the ground. We were so lucky in America that we were so far away from the combatant nations in Europe and in Asia that we didn't take really any serious bombing. The Japanese managed to lob a couple of shells into the forts. I believe it was in Oregon, and you know, some things. And submarines, a couple of German submarines got into New York Harbor, but basically we didn't have the bombing. I mean, Europe was devastated with bombing, and we were so fortunate we didn't have that.
Yeah.
Now, it has been noted by a number of the employees that Imperial was famous for its excellent riveting, as they did an extremely effective job of riveting. They taught their riveters well, and they insisted on absolutely perfect work. They would accept nothing less than perfect work. As a result of that perfect work, the blue and white M pennant and the Victory Fleet flag of the Maritime Commission were hoisted over the Imperial Shipyard during special ceremonies on August the 5th of 1944. This was a very rare award. This award was given for production excellence for the war effort, and Imperial was one of the smallest shipyards in America to receive this coveted wartime award. Of the more than 11,000 shipyards and plants in the United States during World War II, remember, 11,000, less than 200 received this award. An Imperial Lifeboat and Davit Company in Athens was one of them. Now, that's something for Athens to be proud of.
That is. And it reminds me of when we talked about the Mayo Brickyard, how a lot of those bricks were used in the Empire State Building down in the city.
Yeah.
It gives you another perspective when you look at that building. That's where those bricks were from. Little Athens, right? Across the river from where we're doing the Hudson studio here.
You know, it's one thing to be proud of your sports here. It's one thing to be proud of that. But you take that, something like that, the war effort, you know, to win or lose. I mean, think about it. If we didn't win World War II, we will be slaves of the Germans or the Japanese if we were alive.
Right.
Now, me being an Italian-American, that might have been less than desirable. That might have not been, you know, I don't know.
Sure.
You know, who knows what these cultures would feel about people.
Right.
So it was truly a life and death struggle, unlike any other in history. I mean, it was just, and so good old Athens, New York was a very important part of that, and that's something we've always been proud of.
Our little towns.
Yeah, for that
quite
little
a bit.
Town. Now, to that point, and the point being August 5th of 1944, Imperial in Athens had equipped 450 victory ships as well as 100 various tankers, tank ships, with their excellent steel lifeboats. A spokesman at the plant during the war stated that the lifeboats from Imperial Lifeboat and Davit Company had the same priority status as B-29 Superfortress bombers.
Yikes.
So some of the names mentioned, guys who worked at the plant, Lawrence Palmy Palmateer, a wonderful man. I knew that man. He was a barber. He cut my hair. I had the privilege, as a high school student working at Airbelt in the summers, had the privilege of working with this man. What class this guy had. Dignity and class. I miss him so much. He's been gone for many years. Yeah. And he would talk to you. Even though you were a kid, he would talk to you like an adult. And he would share things with you. And, oh, what a marvelous man. And on top of all that, he was a wonderful umpire in baseball. In those days, every town had their own team. And sure. Palmy would do a lot of umpiring. And he was one of the best of the umpires. I don't think I ever heard him swear or raise his voice. Calm, dignified guy. What a guy. Joe Began was a night welder. Henry Boyer was in charge of one stock room. Ariel Weeks was in charge of the other stock room. Francis Kingsley and Francis Palmer were riveters. Carlo Rocca was a planker who helped shape the lifeboat steel hull. And I'm mentioning only a few, a very few of the 500 workers, but the people that I talked to were able to recall these people in a very special way. So that's why I mentioned their names.
It's just fun to listen to these names because you can still hear a lot of these names now, like that Palmateer.
Right.
It's still a good name in Athens. I'm sure it's the same family.
Right.
You mentioned Carlo Rocco. I think he might have been the grandfather of my best friend's wife, I think. Yeah, something like that.
Wow, cool.
I think it was him. Yeah, the name.
What a small world.
It really is.
Yeah,
this
that's
is great.
Now, after the war ends, Imperial will go into the production of 28-foot mahogany yachts. But yet, interestingly enough, in 1946, after the war, Imperial was still producing a few lifeboats for the Navy, apparently to fill out prior orders and to complete their contracts.
Sure.
Okay. Now, on April the 1st of 1947, Jerome McBraswell will sell the property to Power Industries of 122 East 42nd Street, New York City. This will mark the end of the Imperial Lifeboat and Davit Company era and the beginning of the Aerobel Industries era. And that will be Aerobel's first location in Athens and the old Imperial Lifeboat facility. And I'm guessing they'll be there for maybe 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
And they will ultimately build their ultra-modern facility out on Schoharie Turnpike. And they built it. It was interesting. It was built during the Korean War. Grumman Aircraft owned Aerobel. Grumman Aircraft made fighter planes and so on for the United States Air Force, for the Navy. And so when Aerobel was built, it was built in two sections, a production section and a section where the trucks were put together. Okay, well, on those entire sections, there would be no posts on the floor. The ceilings were constructed so that there would be no upright posts. The reason being, at the time the building was built, Grumman wasn't sure that they might not build fighter jets in Athens, and so they wanted the floor wide open. Never did. Never did build fighter jets there, but that was...
They were prepared,
just in case.
That's great.
Yeah. So I gave special thanks to some particular people who helped with this information, such as Harvey Durham, Richard Brunner, Raymond Cure, Jane Even Lone Erickson, Pat Martine, the Green County Clerk's Office provided background on who owned the land there, Mike Peruzzi, Harry Palmer, Sally Heyer Schneider out in Cairo, Frank Gerain, and that one unnamed woman.
Right. Oh, wonderful.
So,
okay, well, this is wonderful, Ron. Thank you for all this information. And now, at the beginning, at the top of the show, we talked about the scope of World War II and we could expand on that a little bit more. We got into talking about the Imperial Lifeboat and Davit Company. So why don't we go back and just discuss the war a little bit more?
Sure. Jack, we got kind of intrigued by the Imperial Lifeboat and Davit Company, and we kind of jumped into that. I might mention that by the end of the fighting in World War II, a total of 56 nations will have been combatants. 56 nations around the world participate in World War II. And we've gotten numerous figures. One figure suggests that 85 million people will lose their lives due to World War II.
Oh, that's just a staggering amount.
Yes. 416,800 Americans will die fighting for their country. Mm-hmm. Now, World War II, to put it another way, will last for 2,174 days and will claim an average of 27,600 lives every day. Every day. By war's end. Now, America became known. We talked about Imperial Lifeboat and Navy Company. It's just one little tiny example of the production might in America that sadly we don't have anymore. That's another thing that's we don't even make cartridge belts in here in America. If we go to war, what are we going to do? Ask the Chinese communists to give us cartridge belts? I don't know what we're going to do. But anyway, to give you some idea of the manufacturing powerhouse that we were, America during the course of World War II picked up the nickname, the Arsenal of Democracy. We were the Arsenal of Democracy. And let me give you a few statistics to bear this out.
Sure.
This will demonstrate just how much of an arsenal of democracy we were. By the end of World War II, the United States of America had furnished its allies the following: 37,000 tanks, 800,000 trucks, 2 million rifles, and 43,000 airplanes. That's for our allies. We're not even talking about what we provided ourselves. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine the mammoth, massive manufacturing machine we were in those days?
I know.
And we've lost it all.
I'm just thinking, just the one example we've been talking about today, just from a little town like Athens, you know, can do what it did with the Imperial Company.
Amen.
Can you imagine what the bigger towns and cities could do?
Oh, yeah, every big city, you know, had manufacturing capacity like crazy. It just it's such a sad commentary. And you know, again, there's all sorts of factors. Unions, unions. You know, I won't do this job. I'll only do that. And they constantly fight for. And so ultimately, a lot of companies just left America because it's labor's so much cheaper across the ocean. You know, there's got to be give and take. You know, you can't, and the owners can't have it completely their way, and union can't have it. I mean, there's got to be some give and take, or we lose. Everybody loses.
Right.
Now all those factory jobs are gone. They're gone. They're overseas. You know, it's it's so sad. But I'm as you know, a big World War II buff.
Yes.
And I'm always looking at that era, and I'm thinking, what would we do today? I'm not only thinking of what wimps some people are today, you know, wusses worrying about burning their bras or whatever they're doing out in public. I gotta say, I'm so glad we're this generation today who didn't fight World War II. What a group we have today. But at any rate, thank God we had the people we did then, but thank God we had the manufacturing that we just don't have today. You know, it was staggering. In 1939, as the war starts, I want to give you an idea of just how far down in the what is known to historians as the interwar period. The interwar period is the period between the end of World War I, which ended very famously. Remember your history class? Did you guys study this in history? Do you know the legend of the 11s from World War I? Legend of the 11s.
I know 11th hour, 11th day.
That's it. That's World War I ended at the 11th hour. Of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, the legend. I wonder how many history teachers out there are teaching that today.
I don't know.
Or how many of them are telling their students how rotten America is. You know, that's unfortunate.
A long time since I've been in a high school class. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't
about 30 years, you know. So
I don't think we want to know what's being taught in the schools today.
Probably not.
Oh, my word. Anyway, just give you an idea. So in the interwar period, between the end of World War I and the beginning of World War II, America had let its military slip tremendously. How badly? Well, in 1939, Germany was a military juggernaut. and the United States was not. In September of 1939, the United States Army ranked 17th in the world in size and combat power, just behind Romania.
Oh, jeez.
Okay. America had less than 200,000 men in uniform, and most were wearing old doughboy helmets from World War I and were carrying weapons that dated to the turn of the century. It was clear that it was merely a matter of time, and not much of it, before America was forced to enter the war. So something had to change fast. We had to get more powerful real quick.
Yes.
On September the 14th of 1940, Congress will pass the Burke-Wadsworth Act to initiate the first peacetime draft in American history as the nation starts to mobilize. And, of course, we all know how Pearl Harbor galvanizes American sentiment, the American public. Anybody that was an isolationist before Pearl Harbor, boy, they dropped that notion. We became united like never before and never since. And in one massive thrust, Yamamoto was right. He had just, all he had done was to awake a sleeping giant and filled him with a terrible resolve.
Wow. That was great.
Yeah. I don't know if we have much more time.
Too much. Okay. We have about probably just under 2 minutes here. Okay. So
I've just mentioned Airbilt came out of Imperial. And I had the opportunity in my high school years to work in Airbilt. And they would make some, they were owned by the Grumman Aircraft Company, and they would make some of the finest aluminum truck bodies in America. They were used by bakeries. They were used by airports. They would put food into the planes with them. And they were so good. They wouldn't rust. They were so good that after about 10 years, these companies would drive the chassis out from underneath the body that was made in Athens and just put a new chassis underneath and bolt that body on.
Oh, that's great.
You just couldn't kill it. The aluminum body.
I guess not.
Curbside, it was called.
Okay. Well, this is great, Ron. Thank you very much again on this short notice and providing us with another wonderful history of a former business in Athens, Imperial Lifeboat and Davit Company. And so I thank my listeners for joining me today. And stay. If you want to find out what's coming up on the show, you can check the Facebook page for Backtracks in Time. And our next show will be on Tuesday, May. I always do this. May 23rd, I believe. So please join us at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, May 23rd, for the next edition of Backtracks in Time. This is Jack Sensabaugh wishing you a great day.